Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this month, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA, released a new database. It's called Nature's Archives, and they say it's the most comprehensive temperature change database ever assembled. Scientists use data to piece together the story of the climate over the past 12,000 years. This data is now allowing scientists to compare our current climate to changes that have happened in the past. Each month, WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz speaks with distinguished professor of atmospheric science Paul Rober as part of our Climate Conversations series. This month, they dig into the new database and how it will help scientists get a more accurate picture about how the Earth has changed over time.
Having some ability to reconstruct information, especially temperatures, but also other kinds of information, like anything that could tell you about what precipitation conditions were like, are very useful. And so scientists have been amazingly clever at how they've been able to obtain the additional information. So you'll see sometimes reports of, oh, this is the highest carbon dioxide levels that we've seen on Earth for the past 800,000 years, which was announced 2 years ago by the World Meteorological Organization. Well, how do they come up with something like that? Well, the way they do that is through, in that case, ice cores. Basically, they drill into glacier ice, and there are trapped air bubbles in that ice, and they can measure carbon dioxide concentrations, and because of the layering of those glaciers, they know roughly at what time in past history those bubbles were trapped. And so putting that all together allows you to get a long period record of what carbon dioxide levels were like in the atmosphere. They can also do isotopic analysis of those air bubbles, and because of that, they can actually extract what the temperature record was like over that same time period. And they do the same thing in the oceans with fossils from the oceans. They can do an isotopic analysis and figure out what the ocean temperatures were like. And those are critical, because knowing what the ocean temperatures were like and knowing what the atmospheric temperatures were like give you a really important, comprehensive picture of what the climate was like over past years. And that really kind of allows us to put our current changes in context. So we know that the increases that we're seeing now in terms of carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels are unprecedented for hundreds of thousands of years. We haven't seen anything like this, if ever. And so that's our way of actually being able to say, okay, we're doing something that's really significant in terms of the climate system compared to what we've ever seen in the past. So that's the value of this information. It really is important in terms of understanding the context in which our current changes are occurring.
The NOAA database taps into 684 sites around the world, right?
Yeah, one thing I would point out about that is even though the sites are distributed all around the world, relatively speaking, you'd obviously like to have even more sites. The more the merrier as far as data is concerned. So you know, scientists are also looking at ways of extending those databases in whatever way is possible to get even more comprehensive picture. And that's, you know, the history of science. A lot of people don't understand this. It's self-correcting and iterative in that sense. And we have a current understanding. Now what can we do to improve that understanding? How can we test some of the assumptions that we've built our current understanding on? So we're always doing that and always correcting it based on new information that comes to light. And in that sense, from a climate change perspective, what we've known over the past 30 years of research is that self-correction has led, unfortunately, to an increasingly dire prognosis about the future of our climate, because the initial projections, while certainly severe, were actually underestimates in terms of the change that we're already seeing and in terms of the projected change for the future. So that self-correction is still working in that respect, but it's working in a way to show us that our initial understanding was lowballing the actual estimates of what the changes we're likely to experience will be.
Another recently published bit of research explores the link between education and climate change. You've spoken in the past about how important it is to arm people with the facts about climate change.
It's important from a lot of different levels. Certainly one level, which you talked about, was just general increase in understanding of what we're confronting is really important, because if you want people to take action, they need to understand what the problem is they're trying to deal with and what the consequences of it would be if you don't deal with it. There are other levels to this too, which you didn't really note in your comment, but I think are important to recognize, which is one of the reasons why education is important that they pointed out is because it shows a direct connection in terms of resiliency to climate change. And the point is that no matter what we do to try to combat it, we sort of have baked in some of the consequences of climate change. And so it's really important for us to not just mitigate or reduce our carbon emissions, but also to adapt to the changes that are actually going to occur regardless of what we do now. And less educated populations, less well-developed economies are much less resilient, that is, much more vulnerable to climate change. And so just increasing the education level, helping to enhance the economies in those places, makes them a lot more able to accommodate the changes that do occur. And so that's the difference between sort of third world countries and first world countries, is that even though many first world countries, including the United States, are going to experience some very significant effects from climate change, because of our wealth, we have an ability to actually accommodate at least some of those changes much better than a third world country can. So that's why the educational aspect is important. Another side effect of this, which they did note in this article also, which is important for people to understand, is as you're developing your economies, all else being equal, you actually increase the carbon emissions because you have a more robust economy, your carbon footprint increases as a result of that. And we've seen that recently with the COVID-19, where everybody was shutting down and all of a sudden all the emissions dropped drastically. That's a reflection of the fact that our economies are dependent on energy. And so as you increase the economies in these places through increased education, you're also going to increase carbon emissions, all else being equal. So the reason I keep saying that, all else being equal, is because at the same time that you're improving education, you can also transform those economies to something that's less carbon intensive using more modern technologies. And so there's been a push in places that are transitioning from third world to more enhanced economies to have them leapfrog the kinds of approaches that we're taking, to look at some more green energy technologies that are now, very functional and capable. But because energy generation is something that has a longer time scale, in the sense that when you build a new power plant, that's going to be online for 30 to 50 years. So the time for you to replace that energy production in a meaningful way is relatively long. So if you have a new economy that's developing and you can jump over that, you can get them started right away using those kinds of modern technologies versus the older carbon-intensive technologies. So there is also an opportunity here, at the same time that you're improving those economies, to actually improve the carbon footprint in those areas. So it may have less consequence in terms of carbon emissions or initial estimates might project. So that's a real positive element. So there's several positives that come from that, which say, okay, you can make people more resilient to changes. You can improve the quality of their lives in the first place. And you can also perhaps make them less energy intensive in terms of carbon emissions while you're doing that. So there are a lot of good things that could come out of that.
If you reflect on the arc of your research and career thus far, and I know we've talked about this before, but did you imagine you'd be talking about transforming economies?
No, in a word. So when I got started in my research career as a graduate student, I actually was studying something called rapidly intensifying cyclones, and we studied them out over the Atlantic and the Pacific Oceans. These are what the media in recent years has talked about in terms of bombs and bomb cyclones. That's really what I started my research career on. So it was really at a time when those systems were not well understood and couldn't be well forecast. And so we were just trying to understand how to do both of those things better. And we had field experiments and a lot of analysis of data that we had available. And we've come to a much better understanding of how those systems develop. And those are very consequential, especially if you think about fishing grounds offshore of North America. Fishermen there were constantly being surprised by these storms because they weren't in the forecast. They would blow up in 24 hours to hurricane-force winds, and many fishermen were killed as a result of that. Drownings were pretty common. That's become much less. It's still a high risk, but it's much less of a risk because the forecasts are much better than they used to be. So that's a consequence of many years of research by scientists like myself that have helped to improve that. And again, that's just what we do in science. We try to understand things. We try to improve conditions. But that's a long way away from climate change. One of the elements of climate change that is does get taken into account with explosive cyclones is to understand, okay, what is the future of explosive cyclones in a changed climate? Will they occur more frequently, less frequently, in new areas? Will they be stronger even than they are now or weaker than they are now? Those kinds of questions. We're still working on that, and there's not a definitive answer on it. So that's an example of an area where it does touch on the kind of research that I began my career in, but certainly not in terms of anything dealing with economics or anything like that.
During previous conversations about climate change, you've described your drive to meet with people face-to-face to share your knowledge. Obviously, in the midst of this pandemic, you're not meeting anybody face-to-face, but do you have takeaways on your mind as we move through this uncharted, socially distanced time?
Yeah, the main takeaway for me is, unfortunately, not a positive one, which is in order to address something as impactful as a pandemic or as impactful as climate change, both of which require sort of a little bit of proactive activity in order to combat it effectively. In other words, the longer you delay, the less effective any actions you take are. And we saw how it played out with COVID-19 is we delayed our actions. Even though we'd been warned about such a thing happening for many years, we didn't really put anything in place to allow us to be prepared for it. And consequently, we had to pay and are paying for a lot of that. And it's the same thing with climate change. So we know what the big picture of this is, and it's not a good thing. We should be preparing for it. We should be taking actions for it. But so far, we really haven't. And so if the pandemic, which is right in our face, it's not something you can put off until tomorrow, and we still do that, what are we going to do with something like climate change, which you can always think about putting off because it's not a number one priority today? It may be next year or in the next decade, but it's not going to be today. So it's much easier to delay action on something like that to make it less of a priority. So I'm very concerned about that. What I'm seeing playing out with COVID-19 doesn't give me a lot of confidence in our ability as a society to actually address issues like this in other than a crisis mode. And we can't deal with something like this effectively in a crisis mode.
So you're saying there's no room for complacency?
Yeah, it's something you really need to address. That doesn't mean you need to shut everything down tomorrow. It means you need to start putting into place those things that we already have the technologies to do that will help to facilitate a transition to something that's much less damaging. We can do that. We can start working on that. A lot of it's just infrastructure. That would help our economy in any case, and it's something we need to do in any case. So why not just go ahead and do it?
Paul Rober is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at UW-Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Benz. You can find more information about NOAA's new database and research on the link between education and climate change at wuwm.com.